In this Climate Gen episode, I'm speaking with Dr. Paul Behrens about how the global food system is vulnerable to the domino effects that arise from conflict, climate impacts, and other pressures. With over 70% of land use on the planet being given over to animal agriculture and vast amounts of plant-based crops being used to feed those livestock, we are emitting vastly more carbon than we need and leaving ourselves wide open for uncomfortable and unaffordable shocks. Paul talks about the changes that we can and should make in order to build resilience and make the food system actually work for all. Emerging science is showing that we are now vulnerable to multiple extreme events in breadbaskets around the world happening at the same time. With 10% of the world's population already struggling to feed itself, is now the time for us all to take the action required, causing a social tipping point that for a change moves in our favour. Thanks for listening to Climate Gen. In the next episode, I speak with Dr. Delton Chen. Dr. Chen is the creator of the Global Carbon Reward Coin, a concept made famous in Kim Stanley Robinson's climate fiction novel, Ministry for the Future. Through the creation of the living systems economy, Chen believes he has a winning formula to finance the restoration of the biosphere, including tackling ecological breakdown and reducing atmospheric carbon. You can subscribe on any podcast channel plus YouTube, and if you want to support this work, you can also back it via my Patreon page. Thank you. Paul, it's fantastic to see you again. We're going to talk about the current food and future food situation. And just to give a context, can you start by providing a current overview on the amount of impact the global food industry has on climate?
Yeah, sure. Great to join you again, Nick. Yeah, it's a bit more complicated than energy systems. So the food system is far more heterogeneous. You know, it's far more spread out and diverse. There's really three different gases, main gases that we're concerned about, carbon dioxide, methane, and nitrous oxide. And different food systems all dominate the food impacts in different ways. Ultimately, when you sum it all up, about a quarter to a third of all greenhouse gas emissions are related to the food system. And that can also include energy emissions that are required to keep the food system moving. And it depends on the calculation type that you make, whether it's a quarter or a third. So it's important to remember that because energy is a big input into the food systems, that energy prices can impact food prices. And we could talk about that a little bit later. In terms of those emissions, about 70% of all the food system emissions come from agriculture and land use change, or the way in which we use land, things like deforestation. But the supply chain emissions, which are the remaining 30%, things like refrigeration, transport, those are processing, things like this, those are increasing over time. The largest component of that 70%, that agriculture and land use change, is from enteric fermentation of beef, so the burps and the farts that we talk about, but also the land use change that is often driven by demand for food to feed animals. So this upstream impact as well. And when we have a look at that around the world, about 70% of food emissions in high-income nations come from animals, and about 22% from animals in low-income nations. So it's highly dominating. So this is almost an old story by this stage, but we really need to focus on it. It's like that old story in energy systems of solar and wind, and people get bored of solar and wind. But in the food system, it really is about hitting the areas that are having the most impact.
Okay. And you said it's sort of spread out, and we still have a choice, because those low income countries, we kind of want them to become higher income countries. And if we're to dramatically reduce our food industry emissions, where would we start?
There is basically already a roadmap for this. If you look at the work of the World Resources Institute, if you look at the Atlantic Commission, if you look at the different ways in which you do the modeling of this, we need a great food transition, in the same way that we need an energy transition. Because even if we do the energy transition well, if the food system carries on in the way it's going, we're going to blow 1.5 degrees alone with the food system. So we need this shift as well. And the great food transition is made up of three things. It's made up of the dietary changes that we often hear about. It's made up of rapid reductions in food waste. And it's made up of changes in the production types. So, you know, the way in which, you know, closing yield gaps, these sorts of things. But when we look at the components of all of those three things, you know, they're not equal. Dietary change and food waste by far have a bigger opportunity for change than productivity. We need the productivity impacts as well, improvements as well, because we will see impacts from climate on productivity. So we will need to try and keep pace there. But really, the dietary change and the food waste are just the hugest possibilities out there.
You just said something which is very important, that if we don't change, then this has the potential to blow our carbon budget and take us to the temperature that we seriously don't want to go. And then also this connection between energy and food, that's a current issue. Energy prices are going up. There's warnings all. I'm just literally on another tab here where I've got this FT article where it says warnings of a global food crisis are not a drill. Can you talk a little bit about that interaction? Because if we're getting a shock now, and this is where we're going to want to come to in a moment, it's that when do the shocks now become the shocks we're worrying about in the future, or are they the same?
So, I mean, they're already there. So yeah, it's a good question. So the question really is this climate impacts taking hold? You know, obviously we've got this conflict in Ukraine and Russia, Russia's war. What we would expect from these systems, these complex systems, is as you layer on more and more stresses, things get more fragile and things get more difficult to respond to. So you only need one extra little push for the whole system to be really stressed. Now, I wouldn't call the war in Russia a little push, but you already had the Chinese agricultural ministry saying that there was a rapid reduction in yield of wheat this year due to climate impacts. We've already got a really dysfunctional food system. You know, what climate change does is it just makes the things that we're already doing badly worse. So if we're already suffering with water shortages because we're over-extracting, because nobody's, you know, conserving or paying for that, then climate change makes that worse. And it's the same thing with food. So we already have a food system that shovels quite a lot of food into animals, a lot of food into animals, a lot of food into biofuels. And, you know, these are sort of demonstrably bad outcomes. And so when you get little extra stresses, it pushes the whole system towards that brink of an increase in prices. And we haven't even talked about things like speculation, of course, financial speculation, but also subsidies that are, you know, that are hugely damaging along these lines. So it's more that climate change is always this threat multiplier, but it's very much the case in the agricultural system as well.
Okay. And, you know, Ukraine and Russia combined, I think, something like 30% of total supply. Who becomes the most vulnerable from a global hunger point of view?
Well, just on the 30% supply, it's 30% of exports. And so, exports. Yeah. So, you know, a lot of countries need to grow food to feed themselves. And so, you know, yes, they're really important in specific areas of the world, like the Middle East. Actually, also for feeding to animals in Europe, for example. We don't necessarily eat those cereals directly. It goes through the animals and then we export a lot of that meat to other countries. So, you know, there's actually a discussion about trying to sort of prop up the industry, the export industry there. When we're talking about who really suffers the most, you know, it's always the people who are precarious in society. So we've already actually seen undernourishment going up in the world. So people who don't have enough macro or micronutrients to have a healthy diet and a healthy life. So around 2014, there were 600 million people undernourished. By 2019, that's 650 million people. And during COVID, that really pushed people up a lot to around 770 million people. So these are sort of approximate figures because there's quite a lot of uncertainty on this, but we do know that it's going up. Around 10% of the global population now face food insecurity or undernourishment. And it's always the people who are poorest that gets hit worse. Now, this can even be true in the rich world. Some rich nations like the UK and the US, I mean, the US have terminology for this, you know, the food deserts, where you have people who don't have access to nutritious food. And, you know, when I grew up in the UK, I hadn't even heard of food banks. And now they're all across the country, you know? So these are sort of really integrated with the global and the national inequalities. Like, these are different mechanisms that are happening on these different levels, but it's always those people that are going to suffer the most, you know, first. But we have to remember that it's coming for the rest of us too, of course.
Yeah. And you mentioned about the exports that are going into food stocks for beef, which is then further exported. This now is coming back into those choices that we should be thinking about changing and breaking that crazy system of getting feed from here, flying it over here or whatever, and then exporting meat all over the place. If we're to build a code of resilience that tries to address the food issue, because we're going forward into this sort of threat multiplier zone, how would you define the low-hanging fruit on this sort of building resilience to get rid of the crazy system that seems to be in place now?
Ultimately, it's that shifting of subsidies towards more resilient systems, both environmentally resilient, but socially resilient. So in terms of productivity, you know, instead of monocultures, looking at intercropping, multicropping, looking at buffer zones so you can reduce the inputs, pesticides, herbicides, these sorts of things. So it's really from the demand side, it's incentivizing those things that we know work. They may or may not turn out to be more expensive in different regions, depending on how you can mechanize that, higher income and lower income regions. And on that demand side, you know, again, it just always comes down to this reduction in waste and reduction in animal products. Because if you can reduce that, then you have a far more resilient ecosystem, because you can take that land that was already in production for animal agriculture, which makes up 70% of all land is towards animal agriculture. And you can take that land and return it to nature, or basically do other things with it. You can be more resilient in terms of the energy system. You can use that land for putting solar panels up. You can have situations where you have biodiversity protection and solar panels at the same time. And so there's some interesting research coming out about that now at the moment. So it's really sort of about that joined up picture of both the supply side and the demand side, and then having a contract, a social contract, saying we're going to look after the farmers are going to look after us, but we're all going to build towards this diet and towards this production system, which is going to be so much better in so many different ways. We talk about all these transitions as being better in so many ways. It's exactly true for the food system as well. So yeah, I mean, all of this would add up to be a far more resilient food system. And we can talk about like eating locally, we can talk about eating in season. These are all really important things. I think they're sort of more second order things. Some people might disagree with me there, but I think those first order things are things like, you know, changing those diets, plant-based diets, using it as an opportunity for exploration of new plant-based foods and reducing food waste.
Okay. And this idea of food shocks and the impact that they have, especially correlating to things like conflict and things like the food price index and correlating to the Arab Spring that happened over a decade ago, we're looking at now Russia and Ukraine are suppliers of food. China, you mentioned, these are all politically speaking, you know, quite dicey relations with Europe or America. You know, the interconnectedness is amazing. And as we go forward and there are potential shocks and exports might stop, how much do you think we are at risk of conflicts arising from these situations?
Yeah, massive. Internal conflict is probably more likely before the external conflicts. There's more of a barrier to that, you know, to actually go to war or whatever. But the internal political destabilization, I think, is a more short-term issue. I mean, I'm not a political scientist, but when you look at the food price spikes of 2007, 2008, we saw internal dislocation much more than external, but then that can bring in external actors. So we know that, you know, areas in Syria, for example, other areas around the world, you will see maybe other actors having interest in that region and making the conflicts worse.
Okay, yeah, this is one of the things that came out of talking to people, to other scientists at the COP. You know, we talk about sea level rise and we talk about melting ice sheets and these big climate impacts, but really it is these conflicts and collapse of food systems or food supplies that are really near-term shocks.
Yeah, and I'm sorry to bring the bad news on this. We'll talk about the good news in a moment, but there is a similarity here where there has been a sort of systemic underestimation of these large-scale changes. You know, we talked about before how scientists have done very well at estimating the average temperatures, but then there's been this underestimation in quite a lot of areas of how fast things like sea level rise, ice loss could go. There is a similarity here happening in the social systems. So the recent IPCC Working Group 2 report that came out last month, so I found a similar thing, you know, that we're actually more underprepared and vulnerable than we thought. And this is actually borne out by a lot of the agricultural modeling that's come out recently. So there was a paper out recently that found that the climate signal appears earlier in the impacts on agriculture, that there may be impacts. This is a really big unknown, but there may be impacts from pests and diseases on crops, because while animals are seeing their range narrow, so, you know, either they're going up in altitude to get to escape the hotter temperatures, or they're moving towards the poles. So animals are migrating, you know, 10 to 20 kilometers per decade towards the poles, and marine life about seven times that, actually, almost, you know, moving up to 100 kilometers per decade. It seems at the moment that on net, pests are just spreading and spreading, and agricultural pests are spreading and spreading. So this is another underappreciated possibility in the future in terms of biological feedback that's extremely worrying. And I don't want to pick on just one or two papers. I'd rather talk about sort of the meta-analyses and the consensus. But one or two papers are showing, you know, that there is the possibility of multiple extreme events in breadbaskets around the world at the same time, and that the odds of that are going up even by 1.52 degrees. So that's where the science is, and it sort of, it's going in one direction in terms of the underestimation.
Okay, well, that's probably the worst news I've heard today. But you said there was some, good side or good news, but do you want to elaborate on that?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So none of this, we can manage with this. We can adapt with this. To come back to this dietary change again, you know, we had a paper out recently that looked at the double carbon dividend of changing diets in high-income nations. And this double carbon dividend comes about because not only do you reduce the emissions from the system, the production emissions from the system, but you save so much land that you could return that to potential natural vegetation. And when you return that, you actually double the benefits over the long term. So you have this carbon sequestration because, or the carbon drawdown, because these more natural environments store on the whole, in their vegetation above ground, below ground, and in the soil carbon, they actually store more overall than in the food system. And that will saturate over time. You know, it will saturate in the total amount of carbon that these areas store. But over the next 60 years, you could double the impacts of your dietary change. Now, we looked at just high income nations, because in lower income nations, there's often a struggle getting enough proteins in the diet. And so in the high income nations, we have those options for proteins. We didn't say, you know, you have to go vegetarian or vegan. You know, we actually took the midpoints of the planetary diet, which was a diet that was developed by the Lancet Commission. And this sort of equates to maybe a hamburger every 2 weeks type amount. It is low. I'll be the first to admit it's about 100 grams of red meat a week. So, but it's not nothing. And certainly there may be opportunities in the future once you have very broad, interconnected areas of land that was once used for animal agriculture. You could have wild ruminants, and those wild ruminants could move around. But we're talking vanishingly small compared to where we are at today. And all of this would just open up a lot of land to be more resilient. The amount of land that we actually need to replace in order to grow more vegetables is tiny. And actually, a lot of it can come from the land that we're using to grow crops to feed animals. So animals in general, just, you know, they only have about 3 to 17% conversion efficiency. So, you know, you're wasting a huge majority of the food that you're giving the animals. So, you know, this is one of the great opportunities. And when you think about those opportunities, when I think about in the future, yes, there will be extreme weather events. Yes, we may have more pests. But if we're able to do that, and I think about that vision, and we help the farmers in a just transition through this, because that's the big part of this, we all have better access to nature. We have higher biodiversity. We have rivers that we can swim in. You know, we've got lower air pollution, because animal agriculture is also the biggest driver of air pollution from agriculture. You know, energy is by far the biggest air pollutant, but there is air pollutants from agriculture too. We lower, you know, antimicrobial resistance, you know, not completely get away with it, but, you know, lower it. I mean, all just so many knock-on effects. You know, there's huge impacts on humans who have to who work in abattoirs, for example, all these sorts of different things. So when I think about some of these changes and you think about this happening, there is hope there.
Yeah. Okay. You're sort of getting back again to choices and thinking about your diet. And it starts there with these choices, but then we have an opportunity to kind of rewild, restore soils, regrow those sinks in a way, And reverse the process. That's the good news option or choice.
Yeah, and the biogenic methane, so the methane that's coming from the animals, you know, once we cut those down, it's not like in carbon dioxide where, you know, the total cumulative effect, if we reduce it by half, we're just, you know, losing more slowly. When we actually cut the biogenic methane, we're actually reducing directly the forcing. So, you know, we actually have that ability to buy ourselves more time by this change, you know, this opportunity. It's an opportunity cost is what I'm saying in these things. And it's just hard to get around when you look at the modeling. No amount of sort of technological innovation, you know, things like vertical farming, which may be an option in the future, but no amount of this is going to help if we continue to eat so many animal products. And things like lab-based meats, it's too far away. And we really want to focus on exploring interesting plants, you know, raw plants rather than processed plants. And, you know, that's always also very helpful as well for our diets and also very helpful for the environment.
Okay. Yeah, this is such an important subject. It really should be a mainstream sort of aspiration. And the Tyndall Centre released this paper, I think last week, about, you know, pathways to 1.5. And it really seems that this is kind of one of those tools that we have to make a real impact, and yet it's not in the mainstream news.
So you see, so it's sometimes it is, but often in this sort of arguments that you hear about the energy transition and net zero, you know, and this frictional thing. They're taking away your hamburgers, you know, this sort of thing. You know, they're taking away your individual rights. I mean, I think we've got to sort of think about this as opportunities, you know, and pitch it as such. You know, this is not taking away hamburgers. They can have that every now and then. It's about cutting it down a lot. And then in return for that, and that contract that you have, you know, your mountain bike park nearby, you know, or you have your nature walks nearby, and you have cleaner air and cleaner water, and, you know, you have a healthier lifestyle. You actually have a healthier diet too, because these planetary diets are better for nutrition too. And I realize I might be sounding like I'm coming off as an evangelist here, but it's just, it's really hard to make these models fit without this change. And you think, like, well, that's just kind of impossible. How could we imagine so many people shifting? But we're already starting to see it. I mean, even a few years ago, a third of the UK public were drinking plant-based milks. I don't know about you. I mean, I work in the Netherlands, and the shelves of plant-based options are just growing and growing, and the different plant-based milks. You've got different plant-based butters, of different plant-based cheeses, even in the main supermarkets. You don't need to go to the, you know, to the specific vegan shop, although they're really great. You know, you can actually just go to your local supermarket and see these opportunities here. And so for me, the food system is just a real example of this sort of social tipping point, you know, and the research seems to suggest you need between 15 and 40% of the minority to flip the entire system. And we could be getting closer to that in the next few years, you know? And I think things will change faster than we imagine, as we also see the prices of meat go up for bad reasons, you know, because the price of grains are going up, because the food crisis is hitting. And, you know, again, it's almost like this same situation with the energy system. Why not make these transitions now while we can still cope with some of these shocks, rather than later, after we've done the damage, and we're always trying to be reactive against these shocks. And by doing the transition now, we also get all of these opportunities. We always also get all of this sort of better life style that we could have. So it's very, very similar in these ways. But I think in the energy, in the food system, it's just even broader if we imagine all the different areas of life it could affect.
Okay. And when we last spoke, we talked about population, and I asked you if you thought that humanity would make the right decisions. You kind of doubted it. When it comes to, you sound a little bit more hopeful on the food side. What's your thoughts in terms of whether we will take the action to prepare, whether we will reduce our meat, land use, and so on? What's your thoughts?
I think, I don't know whether I came off negative with the previous conversation. I'm very optimistic or hopeful that we are. With the population side, I mean, the problem is kind of over. And as I said before, it's not really the right question to be asking. It's more about consumption side of things and how much consumption we're seeing around the world. In the food system, I think these tipping points are very powerful in social dynamics. And that gives me a lot of hope that things are shifting. Whenever I think this, though, it is simultaneously true, as always, that we're seeing massive growth in plant-based diets in high-income nations, but there is still this media scrum to go through, because this will become a politicized issue as energy became a politicized issue, and it's still actually a politicized issue. I mean, it's kind of shocking to me that now this is back on the table as a politicized issue, even after, you know, renewables were basically won by every single, you know, study and metric for 70% of the problem. Yeah, you know, the last the 20 to 30% is going to be harder, and let's just get there and then we'll fix those too. We will, you know, we'll figure that out. And it's sort of the same issue in food. So I wonder whether we're going to be able to learn from some of those arguments that we heard in the energy space, in the media space, and try and address that in the food space. When you look at how far the dialogue's come, even in just the recent years, there does seem to be some hope there. You know, you have to bear in mind that these things do normally take quite a lot of time. And so to see, say, the European Commission, you know, really develop farm to fork, even though the subsidies have sort of really only come down very slowly, the dialogue has changed quite a lot. So now it's that situation of like holding people to that dialogue. You know, what does that dialogue mean? We talked about that before in a previous chat. You know, how do you hold people to that, you know, and measure those changes? So things have moved quite quickly in quite a short amount of time. And even in the time that I've been living here, you know, as I say, this expansion in plant-based options in supermarkets is amazing. And what we do know here, though, is that as those options start to increase in the restaurants and in canteens, meat eaters are really interested in it too. They eat more of it. Then this is what the research shows, because it's kind of interesting options. You know, why not try the mushroom risotto? There's like five or six different options on the restaurant menu instead of like, you know, the wheel of cheese or whatever in France that's the only option for something vegetarian. So we see very strong system dynamics in food consumption. So that gives me a lot of hope.
Now, I like the framing as well around this contract idea of there are benefits. It's not about being an extremist on food. It's not extremist. It's good sense for health reasons and financial reasons and planetary reasons and so on and so on.
And so, I think people get that, and it spreads quite quickly through communities. Once they see that, once they talk to one another, it spreads quite quickly. That's when some problems that we face become quite rapidly addressed, because we're able to communicate with one another. The system changes in response. It really snowballs from there. I mean, one way or another, we need to get to this future, but I wouldn't be surprised if it's earlier than we thought. And unfortunately, it's, you know, sometimes it takes massive crises. I think, you know, for example, the Russia war would actually bring forward, you know, net zero quite substantially in the EU, because you're talking about a systemic change. You know, COVID was never a systemic change. Yes, it opened a lot of people's minds, but you didn't really sort of restructure the energy system much, if at all, really. Whereas this actually threatens a complete restructuring of the supply lines, you know, the blood flow that keeps societies going. And it'll do the same thing for food.
It's like a catalyst for resilience in some respects.
Resilience, yes. I mean, it's going to be very bumpy, I think. But it's an eye-opener for that transition that we know we need to see. And some of these transitions, you know, just really increase resilience. We talked about how this transition, it could increase the resilience of the food system because it opens up land, it diversifies our diets. You know, if you have one pest that impacts one type of crop, then you can, you know, you have other crops with intercropping and things like this. So you've got more eggs in more best baskets, probably the inappropriate thing to say. But also, you know, when you look at, for example, flooding in the UK, some of this can be addressed by massive offshore wind parks that take the energy out of the system. So this is where our mitigation efforts become adaptation efforts, become improvements in resilience as well. So there are lots of these sorts of examples.
Brilliant. Well, I think we've covered everything I have on my list. So thank you very much. It's been good to see you.
Thanks, Nick. Great to talk to you again.
Thanks again for listening. If you are interested to help support this series and help expand the discussion around climate topics, then please do consider backing my channel via Patreon. It will help me produce more content, and you will also gain access to more expert interviews. It would be great to engage more with audiences too and understand your views on these topics.